Holy Father, we come before you this afternoon in great need. We live in a dark world, and these are particularly dark times. And we come to you as the Sovereign One who is light and life. And I just ask that you would be with us in power this afternoon, that our hearts would be open to you, that we would sit here as your students, all of us, that we might go out from this place and take the aroma of Jesus Christ into this city. In Jesus' name, amen. We're going to spend our time this afternoon talking about traumatic memory. But before I do that, I thought I would tell you a little bit about myself and why I'm speaking on that topic. I'm a licensed psychologist with a practice in suburban Philadelphia, and I have worked with traumatic memories for 30 years. I began in the early part of the 70s listening to Vietnam vets. I went on from there to hear from men and women who were chronically sexually abused as children. I have sat with rape survivors, and I have sat with women who have been beaten and had their faces broken by husbands. And because I have also worked with Christian leaders and pastors for about 25 of those years, I have also sat with missionaries who have been kidnapped and tortured by terrorists and raped and at gunpoint and airlifted to Jenkintown to my office. One of the things that I have learned through 30 years of sitting with traumatic memories is that you must not speak until you have listened. And so prior to standing before you today, I went down last night to Ground Zero from 11 o'clock until 3 or 3:30 and listened to the policemen and the firemen who are working there. And was overwhelmed, even after 30 years, of what the church must do in this city for many years to come. If you are to represent Jesus Christ well and bring his grace and mercy into the lives of those who are spending 12-hour shifts in hell, you will need to walk very closely with him, or you will hurt those that he has called you to serve. And so I count it as a great privilege to be here this afternoon and hope that what God and my clients have taught me over the last 30 years will be helpful to you in the ministry that you are already involved in and in the one in which you must persevere for a very, very long time. Human beings, as you know, and if you didn't know before September 11th, you certainly learned it then, commit atrocious acts against other human beings. We have seen it in Rwanda. We have seen it in Kosovo. We have seen it, whether we were looking or not, in our own urban ghettos. And now we have seen it at the World Trade Center. We know from experience and also from the literature that the experience of trauma results in three things: silence, isolation, and feelings of helplessness. Silence because words are inadequate for communicating what is unspeakable. Almost everyone I listened to last night said, "I don't know how to tell you. I don't know what to say. I can't find the words." Isolation, because either no one really understands what we have experienced, or no one seems able to help and enter into what we have experienced. And helplessness, because every attempt to stop the tragedy and the memory of it is ineffective. Some years ago, I had a man from Liberia in a seminary class I was teaching, and he had spent 4 years on the run in the bush with his family, being persecuted for his faith in Jesus Christ. He's a man who carries many scars, physical and otherwise. He said to me one day after class, when I had been teaching on post-traumatic stress disorder, "Let me tell you what it is like for my people. I have a friend who lost his parents, his wife, and his children. He does not speak anymore. He sits alone in his house and will not come out. And he shrugs in response to any suggestion, for what does it matter? Trauma leads to silence, isolation, and helplessness." So we're going to spend our time today looking at traumatic memory and what it is like to live with memories of things such as September 11th. Judith Herman, who wrote an excellent book, which is a classic on trauma, a book called Trauma and Recovery, said this: "Psychological trauma is an affliction of the powerless. At the moment of trauma, the victim is rendered helpless by overwhelming force. When the force is that of nature, we speak of disasters. When the force is that of other human beings, we speak of atrocities. Traumatic events overwhelm the ordinary systems of care that give people a sense of control, connection, and meaning." And of course, without question, the events of September 11th rendered people helpless and shattered their sense of control, connection, and meaning. It was and will continue to be for many years a traumatic event for thousands of people. Now, Dr. Lyles went over post-traumatic stress disorder for you in the previous session, and so I'm not going to belabor that, though I certainly will touch on it a little bit. But I want to also describe it a little bit in a different way. Just using some different words, particularly for those of you who are unfamiliar with the disorder. I think sometimes when we hear things in different vocabularies, it makes it easier for us to begin to grasp what we're talking about. A trauma, which is unlike a common misfortune in life, it's a whole different category, involves a threat to life or bodily integrity. So when something threatens your life or your bodily integrity, that's called a trauma. It often involves a close personal encounter with violence and death. The common denominator of psychological trauma are feelings of intense fear, helplessness, loss of control, and annihilation. There are certain aspects that make a trauma have more severe impact. And I think it's very important that you understand what these are, because as you listen to this list, you will realize that these were all present on that day. So a trauma is in and of itself extraordinary. What happened on September 11th is ratcheted up even more. Some of those factors are being taken by surprise, makes a trauma worse. Being trapped, or being exposed to the circumstances to the point of exhaustion. Physical violation or injury. Exposure to extreme violence or witnessing grotesque death. Those were all there. So you can see that the events of the 11th were not only a trauma, but carried within them all the factors that increased the likelihood of harm to those who endured them. The ordinary human response to danger is a very complex thing, and it involves both our bodies and our minds. And they're simply the changes that occur in us that ready us to either fight to defend ourselves or flee from the situation. Traumatic reactions occur when what we would do to protect ourselves has no meaning. It's to no avail. And so when you cannot run and not get hurt, or you cannot stop a building from falling down like you might be able to stop an attacker on the street, you end up having a traumatic reaction. It's important that you understand that this reaction can occur even from those who escaped the crashing of the buildings and things without physical injury, because you are also talking about people who could not help other people. So there were people that they knew well and loved, but they could not protect them. And so that whole self-defense mechanism, which also causes us to reach out and help other people, was to no avail. And certainly everyone involved could do nothing to stop what happened. There was nothing anyone could do. And so again, you not only have the factors that increase a traumatic reaction, such as being taken by surprise and things, but you have the fact that no matter what level of involvement, that's why the whole TV thing is having such an impact on people, no matter what your level of involvement in those events, there was nothing that you could do. So it's important that you realize, again, that just because somebody has escaped the collapse of the building intact, that does not mean that they will therefore not have a traumatic reaction. And understanding that will silence such responses as, well, at least you got out alive. When action seems pointless, the human system of self-defense is overwhelmed and disorganized. Our response to danger seems useless. And what goes on in us in those situations then ends up even more exaggerated and often lasts for a very protracted period. So if you think of a time in your life when something has happened and you thought you were in danger, and you all know the feeling of the adrenaline rush in your body and everything ratchets up and your mind gets very focused on how to protect yourself and your heart races and you have shortness of breath and you want to run or do something. When you have a traumatic reaction, those feelings don't go away. And so when you've had a response like that to something, and then the thing settles down, and it might take hours or even days or something, but you feel your body coming back down from the adrenaline rush. When you have post-traumatic stress disorder, your body does not come back down. It has to live with that stress, which of course you can see why it's very obvious that people cannot sleep. You cannot go to sleep with an adrenaline rush. So trauma produces lasting changes in our physiological arousal systems, our emotions, our cognitions, and our memory. But another thing that trauma does to us is separate those functions one from another. So when somebody is intact and has not been traumatized, you know, when they're thinking something, their emotions match what they're thinking, and the reaction in their body matches what they're thinking and what they're feeling, and it all goes together as a unit. Trauma often splits all of that up. And so you will sit with people whose cognition will be extremely vivid and their memories will be almost like they can tell you where the piece of steel was on what side of the sidewalk, but they'll have no emotion. Or you'll sit with somebody who's racked with fear and panic, but they can't tell you anything. They can't give you a chronology of what happened. And so those functions that make us whole are all chopped up. And so that's why sometimes it's very difficult to deal with those memories. I heard recently about a teacher who's in an elementary school, I guess, that is over near, I remember driving by it yesterday, over near where the World Trade Centers were, and these little elementary school children were sitting in their class, and the windows overlooked the World Trade Centers, and so they saw the buildings fall, and they all knew that the father of one of their classmates was in one of those buildings. And the teacher said that now she comes to teach every morning, and these little children come back in the same room where that happened every day, and none of them can concentrate, which is, you know, as you remember from what Dr. Lyle said, that's one of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. She can't get their minds to focus. Their cognition is disrupted from the rest of them, and they're not working as a whole. When we've had an experience of overwhelming danger, there are two opposing or contradictory responses that occur. One is called intrusion and the other is called constriction. And so, for example, a victim experiences amnesia, sometimes about the whole thing in a trauma, or sometimes just gaps in memory. And that alternates with reliving the trauma. So the amnesia is where your memory is constricted, reliving the trauma is intrusion. And so you can be doing something somewhere and all of a sudden it's right back there in the front of your head again. Another way that they do that is overwhelming emotion and numbness. So they go back and forth between terror and flat. And another way is impulsivity and inhibition or passivity. And so when you sit with somebody who has post-traumatic stress disorder, they will sometimes do very impulsive things, make very unwise choices, and act out. On the other hand, you'll see them and you feel like you can't move them. They feel like a lump because they're so inhibited in their response. And what happens to people is that because they go back and forth in these states all the time, what they end up feeling like is that the unpredictability and chaos of the trauma just keeps going on and on and on in them. So I can't remember what I want to remember, and I can't forget what I want to forget. I can't make the fear go away, and then I'm numb and I can't cry when I need to. And they feel like they have no control over those states, which at that point they don't. And so it's just over and over again the experience of the trauma. Initially, a victim of PTSD has these intrusive recollections of the event. And they come often as nightmares or what we call flashbacks. One of my patients calls flashbacks a daymare. And essentially what that means is a very vivid memory of an aspect of the trauma intrudes like this long hand into your present reality and swallows it up. So, for example, when I have worked with survivors of chronic and violent sexual abuse, and they begin to tell me a memory of something that happened when they were small, they will end up in a flashback and end up in my office thinking I'm the perpetrator, thinking they're 6 years old and it's happening right then. I found that again and again with Vietnam vets when I first began this work. You know, my very first experience with a flashback when I didn't know anything was in my office with a Vietnam vet, and a helicopter went over the office and he hit the floor. I'm sitting in my chair, this man's on the floor, I'm about 23 years old. And not only did he hit the floor, but he thought that he was in the jungle and he thought I was Kong. And I was terrified because he didn't want me to stay alive. So that's a flashback. And you end up with somebody who's sitting with you, but they don't even know you're there anymore. And so it's very important to understand what that is, and I'll give you some ideas about how to respond to that so that you aren't caught by surprise if that happens. And so you understand that this person in front of you is not crazy. It's not psychosis that you're witnessing. It's a flashback, and I will give you some ideas about what to do with that. The intrusive symptoms like that will often continue for months and sometimes years. However, sometimes what will happen with people with PTSD is the intrusive symptoms will begin to drop off, say, after 6 months or so, and the constrictive symptoms will take over. And I think this is a very key point for the church, because this is where we will forget them. Because they will quit having flashbacks, maybe, or things like that, and they will quit the anger outbursts and all of those things, and they will return to normal. And so we'll think, okay, they're okay. But they're not okay. They're dead inside. They're flat. They're numb. They're not connected to life. They're not experiencing any emotions. And that can go on for years. I have worked with survivors of various traumas who have lived decades in that state. And so until they deal with the trauma in a safe relationship, they stay in that constricted state. And it would be very easy for us to think that they're fine and not have them get the attention that they need from us because somebody else is having flashbacks and they obviously need our help. All right. Judith Herman said this. This is again from the book Trauma and Recovery. Traumatic events are extraordinary, not because they occur rarely, but because they overwhelm the ordinary adaptations of humans to life. And this is a very important point, I think, for you to hear. Traumatic events are extraordinary, not because they occur rarely. My friends, long before September 11th, our pews were full of trauma victims. And oftentimes we weren't listening. Any of you who know the statistics about things like sexual abuse, 1 in 4 women, 1 in 6 men, those are conservative estimates, are sexually abused before the age of 18 in the United States. Now you think about that when you sit in front of a choir of high school kids. 1 in 4, 1 in 6. 1 in 4 marriages have at least one episode of violence in them. And of course, there are many women who live in fear of their husbands. So trauma victims have been in the church forever. And it is important also to understand
As Michael said, that this event is going to drag up all of those events. And so you're not only going to have people who had no previous trauma, who have PTSD in your churches, but you're going to have men and women who were sexually abused at the age of 4, 5, 6, 8, 12, who were also in the traumatic event of the World Trade Center, or people who have lived with violence in their home or whatever. And so I see this as an awful, wonderful place, because you and I have the opportunity, because this crisis has driven us to it, to learn about trauma so that we can minister to those in our pews who have suffered from it silently for a long, long time. I would also like you to keep in mind, as you deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, that the reactions that people have to trauma are normal reactions, underlying normal. They're not abnormal. What happened was abnormal. These are normal reactions to abnormal events. And what we will tend to do is try to make the symptoms abnormal. But they're not. They are what human beings do when they are overwhelmed with bad things. One of the greatest gifts that you will be able to give the survivors of this trauma or any other is the gift of normalizing their symptoms. You know, again and again, when somebody comes into my office who's a trauma victim for whatever reason, they come in and they say, "I think I'm losing my mind." And I'll tell you something, 5 years from now, you're going to sit with somebody who was on their way to work, who wasn't thinking about September 11th, who's going to be walking down the sidewalk, and a piece of concrete facade is going to fall off a building. And they're going to think it's a body. And they're going to think they're crazy. They're not crazy. That's post-traumatic stress disorder. And you will be able to say to them, "You're not crazy. That's a normal response to trauma." "Well, but it's been 5 years. I should be over it by now." No, not the way memories are stored in the brain. Falling things out of the sky are going to trigger memories of other falling things out of the sky, because they're all stuck in the same place in the brain because they're related to each other. You're not crazy. All right, what about traumatic memory? Again, trauma is defined as an inescapably stressful event that overwhelms people's existing coping mechanisms. So one of the results of trauma is that it leads to extremes of remembering and forgetting. Terrifying experiences can be remembered with extreme vividness, or they may resist integration. You can't find a way to put them in your brain. And I want you to understand a little bit about why that is. A lot of traumatized individuals, most actually, will talk about both. Again, there's gaps, and then there's things they wish they could forget that they can't. One of the things we have learned about trauma and memory is that the emotional and perceptual parts of memory, the part that come through our five senses, are what people remember the most or will give you when they talk to you initially about trauma. And that it is different from what we call declarative or narrative memory. Declarative memory is simply the facts. You know, first this happened, then that happened, then I went here, then I did this. When you talk to somebody who has traumatic memory, they will talk about what they felt emotionally, about how afraid they were, or they will tell you something that came into their brain through one of their five senses. For those of you who have listened to some of the stories of people at the World Trade Center the day of the attack, I'm sure you have realized that there's often this sensory component to what they say. And so people might give you visual images. I talked to someone whose sister was there that day, and she said, "All my sister can do is sit there and say over and over again, 'I saw the color of their ties. I saw the color of their ties.'" And she saw them falling. So she has a visual memory. She can't even tell you what street she was standing on or anything else, but she can't forget the color of these ties. Or it may be olfactory. People who are trauma survivors often have very keen memories of what it smelled like, and they can't get it out of their heads. "I don't think I'll ever forget what Ground Zero smelled like last night." or they may have auditory. You know, as I've listened to stories, people tell me what it sounded like when the planes hit, or what it sounded like when the buildings collapsed. Or they may be kinesthetic memories, what it felt like in their body. People will talk about the press of the crowds, or feeling like somebody was going to trample them, or something like that. So those are the kinds of sensory memories that people might have. Or they may say, I was so afraid, I was so afraid. And they'll tell you an emotional memory. When a survivor of trauma tells you a memory like this, what they are telling you feels to them in the moment like an exact representation of what happened. In other words, it's not diluted. It isn't less than. So when somebody tells you how afraid they felt that day and you can see the fear in their eyes, they are feeling the fear they felt the day the buildings fell. Or when they do these perceptual memories, they are going to react to that the way that they did then. Just like a reliving. Normal memory, if you sit with somebody who's going to tell you about a day in the city, is a narrative. You know, I went to the city on such and such a day, I met so and so for lunch, we went to a museum, and then we went to a play. Trauma, one of the ways you know it's trauma is it won't go into narrative memory. It defies the categories. Somebody's not going to sit down and say to you, well, you say, tell me about your life 5 or 10 years down the road. So, well, I was born in this state, and I was raised here, and I went to such and such a school, I got married, I had children, I was in this kind of job, and then I got transferred to New York City, I went to work in the World Trade Center, and 6,000 people died. That's not how people are going to do it. It doesn't go. And so they will either leave it out, or they will put it in a very detached way. And it will sound like it's nothing, only it's reams of things. Many years ago, I was in Atlantic City, New Jersey, on the boardwalk with my then 3-year-old son, and he wanted a lollipop, so we went in a candy store. And there was no one in there, no other customers, and there was an older woman behind the candy counter. And she reached out to adjust some things behind the glass, and I saw the number on her arm, and I knew she'd been in the Nazi death camps. And because I have studied that literature a lot, which I'll talk about in a little bit, in order to learn about trauma, of course, I was very struck by the number, and I looked up at her, and I said, you were in the camps, weren't you? And she looked at me and said, yes, what can I do for you today? So there's that detached thing. I mean, you know what that yes had in it. But that, you know, that's the same thing as, you know, do you, you know, are you having a nice day? Yes, what can I do for you today? It won't go into the normal categories. That is also why when you sit with somebody who's been recently traumatized, you will find that they use a very small vocabulary. And you will also find that they are very repetitious. And so you'll sit with somebody who's, you know, maybe rocking back and forth or something, and they aren't really telling you what happened. They're just saying, I was so afraid, I was so afraid, I was so afraid. Or they'll repeat something else that's a fragment of something over and over again. I want to use the work of a man named Lawrence Langer to help you understand traumatic memory. And I think it's very important for you to understand that as the months and years go by, and people do seem to return to normal, there are going to be, I don't know how many people here in the city, including in this room, people who will live the rest of their life with traumatic memories. They will not go away. And they will always, at some surprise moment, have the power to debilitate and impact a life. You just sort of are sitting in there lurking. And so this city will never be the same. The people you know or you yourself will never be the same because of the events of that day and the fact that you have things in your head that you don't want to remember that you can't get rid of. Lawrence Langer wrote a book called Holocaust Testimonies, The Ruins of Memory. It's a wonderful book. Hard to read in the sense of sad, but he did a brilliant job of describing traumatic memory in a subjective way, not a clinical way. And he talks in there about why survivors of the Nazi death camps, and certainly of any trauma, have difficulty reporting their recollections. He collected detailed testimonies from camp survivors, and he noted as he did so the difficulty they had in recounting their experiences. And again, he says that that is because the experiences of the death camps were so discrepant from ordinary life that the survivor is left with what many people call, and you'll hear it in the quotes I'll read you, a dual existence. And so what you have for the rest of your life is everyday life, which started when you were born and will go till you die, and this co-temporal existence of these memories that are unchanged. And they go sort of like this all the way through life. And so you have this split self kind of thing. The traumatic memories in many ways are discontinuous from the narrative of life. And so people will give you the story of their life 10 years from now, and they will either not tell you anything about the day, or they will give you a blip that just is detached. They won't fit the experience into the narrative because they can't. So you end up with a life story that is never fully integrated because of the nature of trauma. I have found Langer's work to be very helpful in my work with survivors of trauma. And one of the things that it shows again and again is how trauma splits the self and can keep it from being whole. It divides us into me and not me. My life and not my life. One of the memories he talks about, I'm going to give you three kinds, there are many others in the book, but one of the kinds of memories he talks about is what he calls deep memory, which gives us a buried self that we carry with us. And this deep memory is the kind of memory that occurs when you've been through something awful and you try to forget it and it's futile. You can't make it go away. And so you bury it way down. A survivor of one of the death camps, Auschwitz, said this, "I live beside it." You hear that co-temporal existence. It is right there, fixed, unchangeable, wrapped in the impervious skin of memory that segregates itself from the present me. I want the skin to become tougher because I fear it will grow thinner and crack and permit the trauma to spill out and capture me. Another survivor, "I live a double existence. The double of Auschwitz does not mingle with my present life. It's as if it weren't me at all." You can hear the splitting or the surreal quality that people carry about trauma. And someone who survived the attack of September 11th will find themselves some years hence at a business meeting or a dinner party, having conversation with people and just doing ordinary things, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, an intrusive image of that day will pop into their heads. Images of falling things or a smell or whatever. And they will be working very hard at that dinner party to make sure that the skin of memory stays tough enough so that they can keep going in the conversation and not curl up on the floor sobbing. Another death camp survivor, "Sometimes it bursts and gives out its contents. And then I feel it again physically." And again, that's that reliving thing. "I feel it through my whole body. It takes days for everything to return to normal and for the skin of my memory to heal itself." Langer's using two terms. He's talking about deep memory, which is the old isolated memory of the trauma. And then he talks about what he calls common memory, which is, again, just the narrative of our lives and what's going on in the present. And it is that common memory that helps return us to normal. But they function often in two adjacent worlds where there is an occasional spillover into common memory from deep memory. He talks about a common occurrence whenever you're talking to somebody who survived a trauma and they're trying to tell you about it. And I've noticed this with almost everybody that I've listened to since I've been here. At some point when they're talking to me, they'll say, "Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you get it?" And implicit in that, of course, is you weren't there. How could you get it? And there's truth in that. I wasn't there. I can't get it like somebody who was. And so what they're doing there is acknowledging the limited power of words. It doesn't matter how articulate they are or how large their vocabulary is, words cannot capture the experience. But words have to be used or they can't talk about it at all. And so they are stuck with inadequate mediums. That's why you'll often find also with trauma survivors, they will use things like painting or drawing, trying to find other forms to express what they're feeling or what happened, because words feel so paltry. A vast sphere separates what was endured and our capacity to absorb it. Not only within the person who survived the trauma, but also in the listener to the survivor. Never forget that the survivor is remembering what was. When you listen, you are imagining what was. It is never the same. I don't care how good your imagination is, it is never the same as remembering what was. I think one of the things that that calls us to is great humility as we listen. A second memory he describes is anguished memory. And this term is used to refer to memory that just batters the self and finally divides it. Survivors talk about the split in themselves. I split myself. It wasn't me there, it was somebody else. You get this surreal feeling that it really didn't happen to you. You will hear survivors of September 11th speak of their lives as, before the 11th, my life was this, after the 11th, my life was that. Life will never be the same. That day divides it in two. From another survivor of the death camps, in order to survive, I had to die first. To me, the me that I was dead. I died, and I didn't want to know nothing, and I didn't want to hear nothing, and I didn't want to talk about it, and I didn't want to admit it had happened to me. It's not me. My head is filled with garbage, all these images, you know, and sounds, and my nostrils filled with smells. You can't excise it. It's like another skin beneath this skin, and you cannot shed it. I am not like you. You have one vision of life. I have two. I live a double life. And you know what's going to happen as you listen to survivors? Even if you weren't there, you will find yourself echoing that same experience. As you listen to their stories, you will begin to feel like you live a double life. And you'll sit in the pew in church one Sunday, and the singing will be wonderful, and you'll be singing, and the image of somebody's story will come into your head. And you'll feel separate from the rest of the congregation. And you'll feel strange. And you'll think, my gosh, if they knew what was in my head, they'd think I was nuts. Use those moments not to push away, but to teach you what it's like to be a trauma survivor. That's a taste of what it's like. There is a division, this is another death camp survivor, a compartmentalization of what happened, and it's kept tightly separated, and yet it isn't. It must not interfere. The other must not become so overwhelming because it will make me unable to function. So there's this energy that's used to keep it at bay. The last kind of memory I just want to put in front of you is called humiliated memory, and he talks about the self being a besieged self. Humiliated memory is when a person feels such distress that it shatters all their attempts to have this unified, irreproachable image of themselves. Humiliated memory occurs when you remember things that make it preferable to be dead instead of alive. Humiliated memory occurs when people acted that day in ways that were contrary to the way they thought about themselves. You're going to deal with people who trampled other people, and they thought they were kind and loving, and they will have humiliated memory. You're going to deal with people who took care of their own necks and left somebody behind because they were so afraid, and they will have humiliated memory. Those of us who listen will also experience that, because this whole episode, from the perpetrators who crashed into the buildings to the stories that we hear that are not heroic, which we're certainly hearing about, but the other side, which is not heroic, is going to assault us in terms of the way we would prefer to think about people. You know, Christians know that this is a fallen, dark world and we're all sinners, but we often try to forget that and pretend it's nice. And September 11th blew that up, as well as buildings. It isn't nice. People are capable of hideous evil, and we have to live in a world where that's true. And that's very scary and uncomfortable, so we go back to hoping it's nice. And so we're going to feel sort of the same humiliated memory that people aren't what we thought they were, or that we aren't what we thought we were. Humiliated memory is what leads listeners to say things like, "It wasn't that bad." Humiliated memory is what leads listeners to say, "You know, it's been a year, you ought to be over this by now." That's not for the survivor. That's for the discomfort of the listener. To walk into memories of trauma is to encounter deep, anguished, and humiliated memories. It means dealing with content and being at a loss for forms. For such memories will defy all normal categories. To walk into memories of trauma is about speaking the unspeakable, explaining the unexplainable, and bearing the unbearable. Now, I want to give you just some specific thoughts about things so you just have an understanding in terms of working with people with these memories. Not even so much initially, though it will certainly be applicable, but even down the road, a long way. You need to keep in mind that people's response to this trauma is going to go on for years. Not weeks, not months, not a year, but years. And even as people return to some level of normalcy, things can happen that will throw them right back into a traumatized state. And so I want you to understand what some of those things are so you're not surprised by them. And this is by no means an exhaustive list, but what is it? What kinds of things will bring up old memories of trauma for people? Well, there's a whole range of things which in my field we refer to as triggers. And a trigger is merely something that happens in the present tense that sets in motion the old traumatic memory. And again, as Dr. Lyles was talking, this particular trauma did that for people who had histories of trauma, because they feel what they felt then, and so it pulls those memories up. An example of a trigger might be a woman who was raped by a man in a blue shirt. Well, guess what's going to happen every time she sees a man in a blue shirt? It will serve as a trigger to stimulate that memory. So you could have somebody 5 or 10 years from now at work, sitting in front of their computer screen doing whatever they're supposed to do, and all of a sudden the image that comes up on their computer screen is exactly the same image that was on that screen the day they ran. And all of a sudden they won't be sitting at their desk. They will either be in a state of shock and breathing hard and all of those things and terrified, or they might even get up and run away because they'll forget it's 5 years later. They've been triggered into the old trauma. When somebody has a flashback or is triggered like that, you can play a very key role in helping them get back to the present tense. They need reassurance, and they need you to find ways to help ground them in the present, because they have confused the past.